Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, PrecisionHydration.com. Electrolytes in different strengths that match how you sweat. You can get 15% off your first order with the code OXYGENADDICT15. All right, everyone, welcome to the show. I've got a cracking special for you today. We're titling it COVID Recovery for Triathletes. I've got special guest Dr. Anton Krieger back on the show. You'll have heard him just a few weeks ago. Actually, I replayed one of his older interviews just over the new year period. He got in touch and said he'd love to chat to us all about everything that's going on around COVID. So this is a long episode. It's nearly an hour and a half long in the conversation with him, and there is an absolute ton of really great information in there. We concentrate on three main areas. We concentrate firstly on prevention, how you can stop yourself and your loved ones, or you can minimize the risk to yourself and your loved ones of actually catching COVID in the first place. The second thing we talk about is reducing the severity of the disease if you are unlucky enough to get it. And the third part of it is managing the recovery process if you have had it, sort of what you can do to help aid your return to health and to aid your return to training as well. Two very different things. Just before we go into this, I'm just going to give you a quick explanation. The show wasn't out last week and it won't be out next week as well. Unfortunately, just after I recorded this interview, I was personally making some nice progress in my recovery from COVID and I got quite unwell again. So I've had to step back a little bit from the work that I'm doing both with my athletes and with the podcast. So the show won't be going out every week we'll see for how long, until I'm feeling like I'm back to full strength, basically. But thanks to the people who emailed, Twittered, tweeted, Instagrammed, all of that to find out what was going on and to ask if I was okay. I'm feeling much better now, thanks. But I'm just being really careful with the amount of work I'm doing each week and trying to make sure I get enough rest. That being said, over to today's interview of the week with Dr. Anton Krieger. Anton, welcome back onto the show. Thanks very much for joining us. How are you doing us today?
Yeah, really good, Rob. Really, thanks for having me back on again. I think this is a third time round, so thanks for another invite.
It is, yeah, and even one of those I've replayed. You've been one of the most popular guests over the last 2 years in terms of when I've looked at download numbers. The sort of the New Year episode that we did around health, exercise, physical performance, things like that. That was our most downloaded show of the year, or one of the top three most downloaded of the year. So there was a ton of information on that, which was really, really well received. And that's the reason I wanted to come back to you to talk about COVID, because it's a huge issue for me at the moment as a coach. It's a huge issue for the athletes that I work with. And obviously it's a huge issue in society in general, but the thing I found hard is cutting through all the noise and getting to the chase of the information that we actually need to know in terms of how we help people. And I thought getting you back on would be the way to go, because I know you've got an interest in athletes in general through your functional medicine clinic. And obviously you've seen a huge amount of this in your work. So first up, we should jump in with a disclaimer, shouldn't we? Let's do this first up this time.
Yeah. Well, just to get that out of the way, Rob, it's obviously anything that I say during the podcast is not at all to be construed as personal medical advice or prescription, etc. People need to see their own physicians for any personal medical advice. And a lot of what I say will be a mixture of both evidence-based, where there is evidence, but sometimes it will be speculation based on my knowledge of biology and all the published research. And then other times it will be ideas that come from mechanisms that we see with other similar viral infections or other similar diseases. So it will be a mixture, and I'll point out where what I say is not necessarily based on published evidence, because that's quite limited at the moment with what still is a new disease.
Mm. And again, this has been the big challenge for me from both the coaching point of view with our athletes and from doing the podcast, is I get tons of questions about what shall I do. And when I go and try and find the answers, there's such limited amount of data and papers published at the moment for athletes either returning to exercise after COVID or managing trying to not get COVID in the first place. it's such a small amount of data, and it's obviously it's being drawn together as we speak, but most of it comes from very, very sick general population who've been hospitalized rather than, you know, the athletic population, if you will. So the last couple of weeks, we've managed to draw together from the best of what's been published by the, you know, the English Institute of Sport have got their return to play protocol, which I think a lot of sports have had input into. But again, there's nothing specific to endurance training. It's all very generalized around, it might be aimed at, you know, hockey players or whatever. So the guiding principle we've been going off is, look, we've seen a few people who have got incredibly sick, in some cases, looking at the myocarditis stuff, thinking that they've had heart attacks, a really serious life-threatening feeling incidents people have had. We've got to take those people and say, this is what you don't want to get. This is the worst case scenario. And so if it means taking more time than you would like now in your recovery, take a little bit more time now so that you don't see these horrible symptoms later on. So, you know, so really having you on is a cast gold chance for us to ask for the medical information about all this stuff.
Yeah, and no, I think, Rob, there's a very good reason why we're very limited in information in sports science around COVID. Mostly because that sort of research will have fallen on the back burner through COVID. Because in all of our research activity has been 100% focused on public health studies, you know, interventions towards COVID disease and hospital and vaccine studies.
Yeah.
And it's not just sports science. I'm heavily involved in NHS research. And literally almost every other research topic has been paused. You know, most research trials have been paused whilst we've moved all the research resources towards COVID, understandably. And you could see something like sports science being even further down the the waiting list for getting back on board. Yeah. Aside from that, it would be very difficult for sports science researchers to actually do their studies, because with COVID restrictions, it's difficult to get people in a lab and do cardiopulmonary exercise testing where they're going to be breathing heavily and contaminates equipment and
So
that is going to be a big obstacle for quite a while yet. And of course, a lot of this needs long-term follow-up. So many people that have caught COVID or have these problems, really, we only have months of data. We don't have years of data on what happens. But I think we can have a pretty decent discussion in broader principles about, you know, what we know about these problems historically and what, you know, based on what likely mechanisms are and how we can go about ensuring a safe re-entry back to sport.
Yeah, good. So let's start with how do we maximize our chances of avoiding getting sick in the first place? That's obviously going to be the best thing for people in the long term, is if they never get COVID and they never have to deal with it. So let's start with that. What can people do to sort of help limit their chance of getting COVID in the first place?
So there are two parts to this. And the one part is a part that absolutely everybody should know now. So, that's the public health related components. And that's all about reducing your viral load, your viral exposure. And we know it's in the first instance about being exposed to the virus, but it also does make a difference about the amount of virus you're exposed to in one go, if you will.
Yeah.
And we won't belabor the point, but that's our social distancing and masks and hand washing, etc. So that's clearly very important, but everybody should be on board with that by now, and that's part of what lockdowns are trying to do. But the other component to that is really ensuring that we've got an optimally functioning immune system. But that's not a lot of what listeners might read out there is these are certain things to that are so-called immune boosters. We're not really after boosting our immune system, because some of the damage of COVID is in fact sometimes the immune system becoming overactive. What we want is a well-functioning immune system that's balanced and is activated appropriately to deal with an infection like this virus, and then switches off when the infection is gone and is dealt with. And you know what's probably useful here is for those who can remember my first podcast or want to go back to listen to that, I think actually the five performance pillars that I've spoken about as being a very handy framework for optimizing athletes is actually a very easy way to talk about improving your resilience to infection as well.
Okay, yeah.
And as well as how you cope with the infection and recovering from the infection in the end. Because if what I've seen both in a huge number of published studies and what I've seen in the workplace in the intensive care unit of the very severely infected, and unfortunately over the past year I've been involved with treating over 500 severe COVID patients that are critical care level. So I've seen a lot of cases now, and really overwhelmingly, the big risk factor is what we call metabolic disease, and that's really where we're not optimally controlling our blood sugar. And at the extreme end, that's type 2 diabetes, but much, much earlier than that, and sometimes even a decade before that, we can start to have irregularities in how we control our blood sugar. And endurance athletes are not exempt from this. So blood glucose regulation is a massive factor. And certainly if we look at all the people that end up on the intensive care unit with COVID, ultimately all the listed risk factors and diseases that lead to them ending up there have a common root of problems with metabolic health and blood sugar regulation.
Wow.
So, you know, indirectly that ends up with you, you know, having high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, associated obesity. And I've certainly never, ever seen a disease in the critical care unit that has such a strong, tight correlation with BMI or obesity. Usually, body mass index has what we would call a U-shaped curve when it comes to how people fare on the intensive care unit when they're really sick. In other words, if people are really, really skinny, they don't do well. And if they're super obese, they don't do well. But people kind of in the middle do the best. Whereas with COVID, we see a complete straight line from essentially the heavier you get, the worse you fare. And that's, right. You know, that's factual. That's in the public domain. If people look at something called ICNARC, which is our national database for intensive care admissions, the BMI, essentially in 80% of ICU cases have a BMI greater than 25. So over 25 is really just overweight. You know, 18 to 25 is normal, essentially. 25 to 30 is overweight. Obese is over 30, and then, you know, morbidly obese over 35. So most of our athletes do not fall into these categories, but nevertheless, they can still have quite abnormal metabolic health without realizing it. So it's doing everything we can to optimize one's blood sugar regulation. And those other performance pillars, some of them link in with that. And we spoke at length last time about circadian rhythm and sleep-wake cycles and quality of sleep. And we know poor sleep both depresses your immune system but also affects your blood sugar regulation. We spoke about your gut health and your gut microbiome. And there are a lot of COVID studies. Well, we've known for a long time, in fact, that the health of your gut has an impact on the health of your immune system.
Yeah.
And many don't realize about 70% of your immune cells reside in the wall of your small gut. So there's really an absolutely direct link between your friendly bacteria in the gut and your immune system.
Okay.
So they cross-talk to one another. So and we do have something, a recognized thing called the athlete's microbiome. So high-level endurance training can have any effects on the state of the gut microbiome. And then effects that we have on our various hormones can in turn also affect our blood sugar regulation. So all of these things are interconnected. But really the common factor back is doing what we can to optimize our metabolic health is going to stand us in massive stead to either not catch COVID, or when we catch it, reduce the severity and recover better. And then if we single out a single nutrient or micronutrient that probably has the most studied and the most sort of controversial and talked about around COVID is vitamin D.
Yeah.
We do know the a very high proportion of people in the Northern Hemisphere are vitamin D deficient. Certainly at our latitude in winter, it's impossible to get vitamin D from the sun. Essentially, the sun doesn't get to the correct angle in the sky to give us UVB, which is a type of ultraviolet that triggers vitamin D synthesis in your skin. So, it is almost impossible to have optimal vitamin D levels through the winter in the UK. Now, there's been a lot of published stuff around showing some links between low suboptimal vitamin D levels and worse COVID severity. And some early studies potentially showing a treatment effect, but the evidence isn't strong enough yet for us to use it as an actual treatment. But I look at all these things as what I would call a cost-benefit ratio. In other words, what's the possible benefit and what's the downside? So the downside to vitamin D is very low. If sensible dosages have been used, it's extremely difficult to get to a level of vitamin D that would cause any adverse effects. And the adverse effects are really pushing up your calcium levels. But that's at very, very high levels. And there's a linkage between the vitamin D and these other problems. But what we don't know is whether that D causes the problems, but those problems have caused the vitamin D to become even lower. So that's some of the controversy around vitamin D, but the cost-benefit ratio is pretty good. Now, when I say it's linked, we tend to see lower vitamin D levels in people who have higher levels of obesity or more body fat. We see lower vitamin D in older people. We see lower vitamin D where you have poor blood sugar regulation or insulin resistance, diabetes. And we know it's linked with chronic inflammation. So you can see that all the things that are linked with lower vitamin D are also all the things that we've seen repeated publications showing is that's the group that of people who get who fare worse with COVID-19.
Okay.
So
is it a
I don't know if that's sensible... useful starter then.
Mm. Oh, it definitely is. And I was just gonna say, is it a silly idea to say to people, look, there's no drawback here to taking a vitamin D supplement. Almost all the benefits for this are going to be positive. Let's get our athletes taking vitamin D supplements during the winter time, certainly.
Well, I certainly personally I've optimized my vitamin D levels probably for the last 10 years, and aside from COVID, there are several sports science publications looking at which have shown reduced amounts of respiratory infections in general in athletes over the winter time when they maintain their vitamin D levels over 100 nanomoles per liter. So that's long before COVID came along. So for me, it's always been one of the standard things that I check for in athletes. In the ideal world, I would always prefer with most things that is to do it more scientifically and check a level and get your vitamin D level checked, because then you can actually correct it more appropriately.
I see.
And
yeah,
certainly that's something that any GP can do for somebody who requests it, or the other ways of getting your vitamin D assessed. A useful tool that people can look into, there's a free smartphone app and website called D, just the letter D, and Minder. We can stick it in the show notes.
Yeah, okay.
Gives you ways to optimize vitamin D quite comprehensively. You put into it all of your anthropometrics, you know, age, size, all of that. So it takes into account your size and your gender and your age and your location. So it actually works out how much sun you would need at a particular time of year to receive a particular dosage of vitamin D. And you can put in what your target vitamin D that you'd like to be at and what your current is. And then you could work out how much sun do you need and then how much do you need to get from other sources. Because, of course, the best way to get vitamin D remains the sun. In the wintertime, we can't realistically achieve it at our latitude without some supplementation. But in the summertime, we should strive to get it through the sun because we know it's a better form of vitamin D than what we can get sort of artificially through supplements. And the sun obviously has many other benefits, some of which I'll get onto during the chat, which are also related to recovering from COVID. But it is interlinked with the metabolic health. And when it comes to metabolic health, the simplest form there is from the nutritional point of view. There's several components we can look at with nutrition to optimize our metabolic health. And if we look at the nutrition in general, there's really just three things you can change about food. You can change the type of food you're eating. Whether you go low carb, high carb, low carb, high fat, or high fat, low carb, the amount of protein, and of course your micronutrients, vitamins, and minerals. You've got the timing. So when do you eat those different types of foods? And how much of the day, how much time do you spend eating? And then there's a dosage, the amount of calories. Those are the only three possible levers that there are in nutrition. So that's a way to sort of simplify the way to think about your fuel. And if we look at simple ways in which we can optimize a metabolic health. Now, in the ideal world, again, one would be informed with a bit of simple testing that one could get by your GP or approaching somebody like myself, and that's looking at simple markers of your blood sugar control. That's your fasting blood sugar, your triglycerides on a lipid panel, your something called an HbA1c, which is a measure of your average blood sugar control over the previous 2 or 3 months, and things like that. So that gives an idea of whether it actually is a problem for you or not. It might not be a problem. You might be completely, perfectly controlling your blood sugar, and that's great. And then you can just carry on doing what you're doing. But if it isn't great, then it's looking at which of these levers you can pull to start to improve it. So if we look at the type of food, if you are starting to get into blood sugar control problems, you might be better served with moving towards a lower carbohydrate, higher fat approach with an optimal amount of protein, really importantly, good amount of protein. We might also very easily, and a lot of evidence around this now, is looking at things like time-restricted eating, where you spend a shorter period of the day eating. Now, all of these things, obviously, one has to look at in very much a relative sense with athletes. So when I say low carbohydrate, I'm not talking about the conventional definition, which would apply to sedentary people. So for sedentary people, low carbohydrate would mean less than 50 grams of carbohydrates a day.
Okay.
An athlete that's training 10, 20 hours a week, they could effectively be in a low carbohydrate definition, eating 200 grams of carbohydrates a day.
I see.
And that's probably, and I probably put myself into that category. So it very much, it's a relative function. It depends on the amount of activity and the amount of training that somebody's doing. And it also depends on the type of training you're doing. Is it high intensity or is it aerobic training? That's going to impact on it. So I think the for people who do have an issue with blood sugar regulation, who are endurance athletes, I think the concept of periodizing carbohydrates is something to consider. And really by that, I mean it's looking at both how much carbohydrate you eat, but also the timing of it. So if you're going on a day where you're doing a very high intensity long session, that's following that is the appropriate time to have most of your carbohydrates, when your body is maximally insulin sensitive and can take them all up and shift them into your muscle stores. Whereas if you're having a rest day, you're probably better served on that day for that to be a lower carbohydrate, higher fat day.
I see.
And these things can be periodized, just like we have periodized training, we can have periodized nutrition.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? Reducing just very slightly the amount of carbohydrate that athletes eat on their recovery days, and allowing yourself, essentially you're kind of earning the credits to eat more carbohydrates by doing more training, aren't you?
Yes, and exactly. And what you're really trying to do is you're trying to make sure that every time you eat carbohydrates, the body has got the right hormones firing, which is mostly insulin. So that carbohydrate that's taken up is just enough to fill up the glycogen stores in your liver, ready for your next glycolytic training. And the rest of it can all shift into your skeletal muscle stores and get stored there. What we don't want is for it to end up just sitting in the bloodstream and cause prolonged raised blood sugars, which is what causes damage to the immune system, to the arteries, the blood vessels, etc. And we don't want it to then go and get excessively stored in the liver, where you get a fatty liver or in other organs, because that's where you end up with chronic inflammation. You become that more at risk group, not just for COVID, but for all chronic diseases, going forwards. COVID has really just raised the awareness of all of this. Everything that's causing the acute pandemic in COVID has really been coming on for decades, leading to the chronic disease pandemic.
Gotcha.
It's just more rapidly brought to the fore. But if I look at a lot of simple things you can do around improving the metabolic health, the one is that periodizing your carbohydrates. The other is, and I won't go into detail yet, but I have some very practical ways of further personalizing carbohydrates in the sense of which carbohydrates you as an individual are more tolerant of, because you and the listeners are probably familiar with the concept of glycemic index that's put on foods, GI, and they get rated as, seven, a white potato might be a glycemic index of 100, and a piece of broccoli might be 20, and so forth. And it's really saying if you eat that food, the higher that glycemic index score is, the higher it's going to push up your blood sugar when you eat that type of food. The problem with it is that the research that underpins it, like many things, very rarely gets questioned. But if you actually go back and look at it, it was conducted on 10 or 20 males in the 1970s.
And
for all those foods, they gave them those foods, they measured their blood sugars, and they took an average of the 20 people. But really, essentially, in the last couple of years, we've had some massive studies repeating that work, but done in 3,000 or 4,000 people, and using continuous glucose monitors, looking at their microbiome and all the rest of it. And essentially, it's been really interesting what we found out. We found out that the average for those GIs is actually about right. The averages are correct. So GI for white potato on average for the population might be, I don't know the exact number, but let's just say it's 100. But at an individual level, it's complete nonsense. Every one of us is bio-individual. We all have completely different. You might be 100 for white potato and I might be 20. And you might
really?
you might be 20 let's say a white rice, and I might be the other end of it. So we all have different carbohydrate tolerances or glycemic tolerances for different carbohydrates. And that, so understanding that is another very useful way of informing what you include in your diet and what you don't. Or even if you include something that does tend to push your blood sugar up, you're doing it in an informed way. You understand that and you've decided, well, you just fancy it anyway. But at least it's a knowledgeable thing. And there are ways to look at this in a practical sense. The time-restricted eating I spoke about, and interestingly around that is that what I mean by that really is that most people in the modern world spend their whole waking hours eating and snacking and nibbling. So they might spend 12 to 16
sounds familiar.
Hours eating something. Exactly. And whereas that's not really what our evolutionary biology, you know, hunter-gatherers ate something every few days and then went hungry for a bit and found something and so on. So our biology isn't set up for that. And there are a lot of studies showing where people reduce the hours that they eat in a day down to anything from 8 to 12 hours. And even 12 hours shows a huge benefit. It improves metabolic health, improves blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. So all those things that you're after. And importantly, it's not about reducing the total amount of calories you eat. You're just getting those calories in into a shorter number of hours of the day. Because what we don't want in our athletes is to get into relative energy deficiency or sport problems where they're underfeeding for the amount of training they're doing. But one can contract the hours that you feed in. And you can look at either doing that earlier in the day or later in the day. Earlier in the day, in theory, can be better, but socially it's not as good if you want to eat with the family at tea time. But earlier in the day, your insulin sensitivity is naturally higher. The other bits around metabolic health is the bits we talked about earlier. It's absolutely optimizing sleep, and it's doing things around reducing stress, which are both going to play havoc into it, and then the effect of training itself. So you can see there's a lot of simple things we can do around. Oh, and the final thing I wanted to mention, which is really, really simple, but it's a quick win for anybody, is simply going for a 10-minute walk, roughly 20 to 30 minutes after you eat a meal.
Okay.
And that easy 10-minute walk and how fast the sugar shifts from your blood to your skeletal muscle stores.
Interesting. So there's really something to the kind of the old wives' tale of firstly, don't eat anything after your dinner in the evenings, and secondly, to go for a short walk after you've had a meal. There's real benefit to those two simple things.
Almost everything your grandmother told you to do is right. We've just taken decades to develop the science to be able to explain it and prove it. And yeah.
I love that. That's perhaps the title for this podcast. Almost everything your grandma told you would be right. So that goes over a lot of the things we can do to help prevent catching COVID. And it's really interesting, Anton. This just reinforces what you said last time you were on the show. There's a lot of sort of not common sense, but a lot of sense here that if people could do this every day, it would vastly also reduce their chances of catching COVID. Is there anything else you want to add in there before we go on to the idea of how do we get people to reduce the severity of their symptoms if they do get the illness?
Well, in danger of us making it a monstrous podcast, really adding, I'll probably leave it focused on vitamin D and really optimizing your metabolic health.
Yeah.
There are a lot of other micronutrients which may be a benefit. You know, it's ensuring you're healthy in terms of vitamin C, vitamin A, many of these other nutrients. What I suggest I do is I've got a single A4 sheet, which really is what I call a nutrient dense food list, where it just lists the best food sources of the important nutrients. It actually lists almost all the important micronutrients, but I can highlight the ones which potentially are more important, specifically support our immune systems. And then that could be available in the show notes if you wish.
Yeah, that's a great point.
About, I think in the first instance, we need to get as much as we can from whole foods. And ultimately, it comes back to a real food diet. If you've got to read the side of packaging, it's not food. And, you know, really what we're after all comes back to food. What I will say there for a second, food-wise, if we've talked quite a bit there about blood sugar regulation with the nutritional approach and about these different micronutrients, but just briefly talking about food and our gut microbiome, because I did mention that as one of our five performance pillars and how that interacts with, it also interacts with blood sugar control, interestingly. The makeup of the friendly bacteria in our gut can influence our insulin resistance alongside the immune system. Now, if we look at things that maintain a healthy gut microbiome, stress negatively affects it. Bad sleep, again, negatively affects it. Obviously, any infection can affect the gut microbiome. And of course, antibiotics, often we can't avoid them and they're absolutely necessary. But we're not completely necessary. They wipe out the gut microbiome. So it can take up to 18 months to recover without any help. It would take 18 months to recover after a course of antibiotics. From a food point of view, we really want to think about eating fruits and vegetables that cover the colors of the rainbow across the week. So if you go shopping in the fruit and veg aisle, really look at 5 to 10 servings of fruit and veg a week and get all those bright colors. Because all those colors, you want to cover the different colors over the week. And that can be a bit of fun with the kids to pick different colors. And it makes you eat maybe fruit and veg you haven't tried before, some more unusual things, and make it varied. Your gut microbiome's after variety, but those different colors are also different, what we call phytochemicals and phytonutrients. And a lot of those are very effective in our cardiovascular system, our immune system, and so on. So it's the blues and the purples, the oranges, the reds, particularly the berries and all the cruciferous vegetables and so on. The other thing is to include fermented vegetables to also add some sort of natural probiotics. So those colors of the rainbow covering your prebiotics and phytochemicals and fibers. And the fermented food, cheese, kombuchas, the sauerkrauts, etc. Those have given you some of your natural so-called probiotics. And I think that's a good start, a good place to get going with just maintaining that gut microbiome. And not just for COVID, long-term as an athlete.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, so we said at the top of the show, obviously we're starting to see now, unfortunately, more and more. I think a year ago, we were super aware of this and really worried about people getting it. But I didn't know very many people, didn't come into contact with very many people who tested positive. And it seems like over there, certainly in my personal circle of people that I know, the last 2 months or so, it's just gone through the roof. Almost everybody seems to be getting the disease and testing positive for COVID. So I think the next thing to talk about is how do we reduce the severity of the symptoms if we possibly can once we've tested positive or if we test positive?
So I think, well, the first common sense advice, which would be the general NHS advice, you know, get extra sleep. A lot of what we've spoken about already, but if further emphasized, I would clearly stop training, formally training. Plenty of fluids, keep well hydrated, plenty of sleep. Further, you know, continue with the supplementation that we've chatted about, you know, ensuring that you do have good levels of the nutrients that you're in, the vitamin D, zinc, etc. And in terms of your gut microbiome, what I didn't mention previously, but which is also very helpful, is bone broth. And that's probably, particularly when your appetite is low, when you actually have infection, that could also be very helpful in terms of supporting the gut microbiome.
Okay.
During this phase.
Yeah, the it's interesting because when I was ill, I don't know whether other people experienced this, I had no appetite. I just couldn't be bothered. I couldn't be bothered doing a lot of things. I was interested in nothing, but eating was a particular one. And obviously I knew, you know, you need to go and eat something. You need to get some nutrients. I had no interest and no enthusiasm to eat anything. So the bone broth would have been great to know about at the time in order to, when I was just going for essentially soup, you know, something that's easy to try and get some salty fluids into my body. But the bone broth is a great tip there, I think.
Yeah, well, it's you know, you naturally don't have an appetite when you're ill, and that's for a good reason. Fevers and illness, that's essentially your body is putting all its energy production. You know, as an athlete, that you've got these energy factories in your cells, the mitochondria, pumping out this ATP or energy currency. But when you become as ill as that, really, all of that energy is going to power your immune system,
yeah,
your survival, and your vital organs. So you naturally then are taking any energy away from doing stuff. And it's really telling you to take it easy. And fever in itself is increasing that energy usage and energy consumption. So you want to have ways that are as easy as possible to get nutrition in. And as you said, bone broth is an option. And the other thing I would say is energy-dense smoothies that are full of nutrients that are easier to swallow and get your calories in, but also get lots of nutrients in.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when you don't have an appetite for eating and chewing a lot of solid food.
Yeah, of course. So
probably useful things. The important thing is when you are ill, and you've had your confirmed COVID test, is really constantly monitoring yourself. And clearly, if you feel that you're starting to get those symptoms and move you into a more severe category, you have to get yourself towards hospital or certainly speaking to the NHS and getting advice on whether you're now at the stage where you no longer should be at home and you should be managed in the hospital with you know, the interventions we provide there. But whilst you are at home, The simple things are the rest, the hydration, the nutrition we've just spoken about with those additional nutrients we've spoken about. I would still try and move, you know. I would regularly get off the couch and walk around, because one of the things that would concern me about doing nothing at all and only lying in one place is that one of the big issues we certainly see in hospital, and we don't really know how much of an issue it is for people at home with more mild disease, is the fact that COVID causes the blood to clot much more readily. And
right.
Blood gets stickier or thicker. And certainly some of the people that sadly die from COVID don't always die from the inflammation of the lungs, but they actually die from getting big blood clots that either cause strokes or heart attack in itself, or pulmonary embolisms, or clots in the lungs. Because of this increased sort of stickiness of the blood from the virus. So that's another reason to stay well hydrated.
Okay.
Some people might consider, but I would say as a disclaimer, to first speak to their GP or the NHS about it, and providing they have no contraindications in terms of gastric ulcers and gastritis, etc., some people may consider a low-dose mini aspirin, which one can buy over the counter anyway, just to keep the blood slightly on the thinner side. But I'm not suggesting to the listeners to take that. That is not medical advice.
Yeah.
It's something they could discuss with a medical practitioner. But essentially what I'm getting at is things that reduce your risk of getting a DVT or blood clotting. And it's just the same sort of advice I'm sure you all know about when you're an athlete and going on a long-haul flight off to your races. And we certainly know plenty of athletes who've picked up DVTs and PEs returning from races on flights with exactly the same sort of issue going on.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Let's rewind it a little bit and explain to us in as layman terms as you can, I suppose, what actually is COVID and what does it do to our body, and why is it causing us so many problems? There's three questions there. So the first one, I suppose, is, what is COVID? And following on from that, what does it do to our body?
Okay. So I suppose the first bit is to say this, this actually comes nicely under the original Donald Rumsfeld, one of the, if you remember, he was one of the US Secretary of Defense, where he made the statement about known knowns, known unknowns, unknown unknowns, and unknown knowns.
Yeah.
And that's probably where we are with COVID. We have some known knowns, but we've got a lot of unknown unknowns, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of what we do know, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners will know a lot of this, we know it's caused by what we call SARS-CoV-2, which is just the fifth of the so-called coronaviruses. The first three or four become endemic as a common cold. And then we had one about 10 years ago that came along that was SARS-CoV-1 and just caused issues really in the Southeast Asia and Canada, and then luckily got under control and disappeared, more or less. And then the Middle East Respiratory System virus, which is called MERS. So those two, MERS and SARS-1, caused actually more severe disease than COVID-19, but they didn't spread as easily. They were so severe that sort of people got so ill they didn't have a chance to spread it. COVID-19 spreads very well because it's highly transmissible, but at the same time has a long enough incubation period for people to spread it unknowingly. And although much more, you know, we now know it's much more severe than influenza, it's not so severe that it sort of wipes people out before they can spread it a lot, if you see what I mean. So it's kind of that perfect storm of spreadability and being dangerous, but not lethal enough to stop it spreading quickly.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
We know its port of entry is through the lining of the nose and the upper respiratory tract. And then in those who start to get it a bit more severely, they've inhaled it and it starts to infect the lining of the cells of the lung passages and the lungs themselves and the lung alveoli. And the majority of the population, it probably most of the time in most people, is just sort of stopping there. And they're just getting either those no symptoms or mild symptoms, and that's it. Where it starts to become much more severe is where it's causing a much more severe inflammation directly in the lungs. And then the so-called ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is not a disease in itself. It's really just a description of symptoms of really just very low oxygen levels and a lung that is very inflamed and becomes very stiff. And people that have that by definition are the ones that we all have on oxygen in the hospital. And the more severe end on ventilators or breathing machines. But the patients that get to that point, what we really have seen is that it's not so much just the inflammation of the lung. It's in conjunction of that, what I was talking about earlier, where the blood becomes thicker and starts to clot. So they start to develop damage of the arteries, of the lining of the arteries, and getting little bits of clot and bits of inflammation and sort of lots of inflammation in the lining of the arteries. And, of course, in the lungs themselves, it's the lining of the tiny capillaries surrounding each alveolus, each little air sac. And if those are getting a little blocked off by clot, by blockage, tiny little bits of blockage, and at the same time the lining of the air sac itself is inflamed, we have this issue where oxygen just can't get across. And then it can't carry it around the body, and we have these low oxygen levels. But it seems in a lot of people that the vascular component, or the damage to the blood vessels and the arteries, is almost the bigger issue than the airways themselves, which is a little bit different to most other causes of ARDS. All of them involve both. All of them involve issues with the vascular system as well as the air sacs themselves. But this seems to vary in terms of the balance. So I actually think of COVID-19 in the more severe patients as more a lung-initiated disease, but overwhelmingly more a vascular disease. So it's actually a vascular disease that's come in via the lungs.
Right. So, So the issue is that as well as having, you know, the alveoli in the lungs that can't absorb the oxygen very well, you've also got lots of tiny, you know, that the immune system's attacked, inflamed the small arteries and veins down there, and you're getting essentially blocked up from both sides. Would that be the right way to think about it?
That's the way to think about it, yeah, because the air sacs don't only get inflamed. When they get inflamed, we get shifts of fluid inside those air sacs that wouldn't normally be there. So it blocks air moving, but it also makes these air sacs get obstructed or they collapse and they can't open up again. And all sorts of mixtures of those different problems occur. And even at the severe end, if you feel short of breath or you're coughing a lot, you've got a little bit of that going on at a more minor end of the spectrum, and everything's a spectrum. But those are all the different variety of things going on. And that's partly why the metabolic disease is so much the risk factor, because if you've got metabolic ill health leading into this, you already have got a degree of inflammation of your blood vessel wall.
Right.
But you're already sitting there kind of predisposed to the trigger.
Got you. So the perfect storm, isn't it?
Exactly. You're much more easily going to express exactly what you were saying there. We actually call it immunothrombosis. So it's exaggerated blood clotting triggered by the immune system. So it's not always necessarily so much directly the virus in itself. It's the trigger that the virus has had on our immune system, which is sometimes overactive and exaggerated.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, I've heard that before, actually. It's that sort of overreaction of your immune system that is, you know, it's doing a great job, but it's doing it too well and is actually causing more of the problem rather than helping solve it.
That's right. And a lot of what we don't know with prolonged COVID symptoms is how much of it is still the presence of a degree of chronic viral presence versus how much of it is the virus long gone, but the aftermath of its triggering of the immune system and ongoing excessive immune activation. I mean, my thoughts on post-COVID, and really when we talk about that, it's now being talked about as roughly, and I mean, these are very arbitrary numbers and they're somewhat made up, but we can think of it as post-acute COVID, where you still have symptoms for more than 3 weeks after you had your illness. And we can think of chronic COVID-19 as more than 3 months after you've had your illness. Now, really, that's just defining how long you're having symptoms. But I personally think, looking at the different studies and data and people I've seen, that there are a lot of different reasons for this. And there are different buckets they'll fall into. And so will your athletes. There's going to be some, and they're probably going to be more the people who have had severe disease and have been in hospital or in ICU, who've sustained some degree of permanent or semi-permanent lung damage. And in terms of the result of the severe inflammation, there's been fibrosis or sort of scarring in the lungs, which may longer term reduce their exercise tolerance. You know, there'll be a reduction in lung function. And there may also be some longer term tiny blood clots that affect lung function.
Yeah.
Now the NHS is actually working quite hard in setting up long COVID type clinics. And there are documents going around looking at how these will be set up, et cetera. And I think there's some of these causes that are actually quite easy for that system to diagnose and fix up, and others would be quite difficult or challenging for them. And they're more things that I spend a lot of time looking at. So if we look at it, it could be the lung damage group. Now, in the NHS setting, that's simply doing lung function testing, and if it looks abnormal, one could, in the first instance, it's chest x-rays and it's CT scans and lung, and you'd have your answer. You could see that, you know, that damage there. Then you've got the group you spoke about earlier, where you know, we've spoken about the virus ending up in the lungs. What we do know now is that it can infect virtually any tissue in the body,
right?
But most commonly, the arteries and blood vessels, as I've spoken about, where it inflames them. And, you know, in my case, I mentioned my COVID toes. Clearly, in you know, I had a predisposition to that as a little area of weakness, and I ended up with some minor little vascular inflammation and probably tiny little blood clots in that part of my circulation in the toes. But equally, we know it can infect the gut lining and alter the gut microbiome. And then we have the possibly neuroinflammation or affecting the vagus nerve and traveling up into the central nervous system. And everybody in the simplest terms is aware of one of the key symptoms for testing being change in loss of sense of smell or taste.
Okay.
So, you know, that clearly is a neurological component. But there are also people as part of long COVID that have long-term, you know, experiencing brain fog and, you know, various other nervous system symptoms. So we've got all those different areas, and there's also been published increases in autoimmune disease following it, and that then fits again with the immune system in some people not switching off properly again.
Yeah.
Starting to recognize your body as being foreign and not just the viral infection. And then we've got a whole group that really just have prolonged fatigue, brain fog. And they really are ultimately what we've been dealing with for many years, large groups of people with chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, stroke, ME. And that's really oftentimes in the NHS looked at as a group of people where they can't make a diagnosis to what's causing them to be fatigued. And it's often considered just to be psychological or psychogenic and managed with pacing themselves and cognitive therapy and so on. But in most of these patients, there are actually underlying reasons and causes for it. It's just being able to look carefully enough and in enough detail to find the causes. And COVID-19, in my view, a large group of this is really just because chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, is really just describing symptoms. All it's saying is that you're chronically fatigued. And at the same time, you, alongside that, in some people experience muscle pain after exercise, joint pain, and get brain fog and concentration issues. So it's just describing symptoms. And these are just the symptoms that many people are describing with long COVID or chronic COVID. So that will be another bucket of people that all fit into that grouping. But as you can see, they all have potentially different causes. They've all been triggered by the virus, but it's a different effect that the virus is having in a different part of the body.
Of course, yeah.
The mechanism.
And so from what you've said there. Sorry, go on.
No, I'm saying would need a different approach in terms of managing it.
From what you've said there, it's very interesting that the framework that's put this within, when we think about the fact that we've got inflamed alveoli in the lungs, we've got an increased propensity for the blood to clot and the danger of, you know, deep vein thrombosis and things like that. It's almost answered the next question that I'm going to ask, which is, I wanted to move on to talking about the dangers of athletes returning to training too quickly or returning to intense training too quickly. But I've kind of answered that question already. If we've got blood with little clots in, if we've got little arteries around the body that are already damaged, if we've got alveoli in the lungs that aren't transferring oxygen very well because they're damaged and there's fluid there, that's a clear part of the answer, isn't it? We can't have people thinking, well, you know, I don't have a cough anymore, let's jump back into an FTP session. The dangers there are clear to see, aren't they?
Yeah, I'll just clarify though, Rob, that those issues will vary massively on the severity of COVID somebody has had. So it may be at the asymptomatic or very mild end. They may just have had a bit of inflammation of the upper respiratory tract and none of these other issues. Or they've just had a bit of inflammation in their lungs and made them cough a bit and slightly short of breath, but without any of those potential little blood clots and issues elsewhere in the body.
Yeah.
Or anything in between. So it's very, you know, I don't want to paint a picture that every athlete who thinks they've had some mild COVID has got all of these disastrous and complications and is overly worried about it. But at the same time, it's impossible to say whether they have or have not without, without potentially assessing. But it would very much depend on the severity of their symptoms at the outset. What I would say is I think there potentially are some very sensible and practical things we could do to assess our recovery.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the place to go to.
I think so, yeah.
Now, I think some of these things that are really at partly just ideas of mine and things that I pull from what I look at outside of COVID, but also make sense of the mechanisms and with COVID itself. And these would make even more sense if one has been doing them long term, so that you actually have a baseline to measure your change if and when you actually got COVID, and then measure your change when you're recovering from COVID. So right. That would be even better, so that you can see serial change. So the one is the one that I believe you've had Marco Altini from HRV for Training on your podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think I drew attention to HRV on the first podcast we have as one of the
things. Did, yeah, very much so.
Stress on the system. Now, in fact, I've published a while ago a review of the use of not just sport, but it's been known for decades that it's very useful in predicting all sorts of acute diseases coming on, and also how well somebody's going to do when they get that acute disease. And in fact, there are actually a few studies coming out of using heart rate variability in the intensive care unit to monitor COVID and direct some treatments. So it would be very useful if one was already monitoring heart rate variability. And for those who haven't heard anything about it, in simple terms, it's really just a measurement of the amount of variability of the time between your heartbeats, which is fractionally altering from one heartbeat to the next, such that if you looked at a heart tracing, your heart tracing will look regular, but there are changes in thousands of a second in timing between the heartbeats. And that's the greater that variation is actually a good thing. And you want some variation in that. So the greater the variation, the higher your heart rate variability. And that really means that you have better balance in the automatic part of your nervous system. And essentially means that the parasympathetic or rest and digest system is working properly, and you're not overactive on the sympathetic part of your immune system, which is a fight, flight, freeze side of your nervous system. Sorry. So that's essentially what it's looking at, and ultimately that's a balance. That's showing the amount of load or stress on your body. Now, that's all stress in your body. That could be the stress in terms of the amount of sleep you're getting, the stress of your diet, infections that you're getting, your training load. The body can't tell the difference. It's all just stress. And at the moment, it can include stress of lockdown, stress of people losing jobs, all the psychological stresses that are going on. But nevertheless, it's a very good marker of your overall stress load. Now, if you're measuring it and you then get COVID, and I would be surprised if you didn't see a reduction in your heart rate variability whilst you're ill. Looking at it as you recover would potentially be a very useful indicator of when you've become fully recovered. When you see your heart rate to your baseline. So I think that would be one useful way to look at it. A more simplistic is to keep an eye on your resting heart rate in the morning, your waking heart rate, which athletes have been doing for decades. So that would be another easy indicator of when you're starting to become recovered, when your baseline heart rate is returned back to normal.
Yeah, okay.
And another one which I'm not sure how many people have heard of, and I do a lot around different ways of breathing and breathing techniques. And I think there's going to be a lot more about this in endurance training. But without going into too much detail, there's a score called a BOLT score, and it stands for BOLT, stands for body oxygen level test. And it's very simple. And again, in the ideal world, you might do this now, and anybody can do this listening to the podcast. You just breathe normally and then take a normal breath in and a normal breath out through your nose. And when you complete that breath out through your nose, pinch your nose closed and hold your breath for as long as you can, not for as long as you can, but hold your breath just until you get your first urge to breathe again. And if you can only do, if that breath hold is less than 25 seconds or certainly less than 20 seconds, that's low. That's too short. And you potentially have, you still don't have good body oxygen levels.
That's interesting. It's
very, very simple.
Yeah, that's really simple, isn't it?
Now, the only caveat there is it would be ideal for people to do that pre-sickness, because interestingly, there are actually quite a lot of high-level athletes, even Olympic athletes, with even quite good VO2s who've actually got poor BOLT scores because they've got dysfunctional breathing and they don't breathe in an optimal fashion with diaphragmatic breathing, nasal breathing, slow breathing, all these sorts of things. And they're things that can be trained and improved. So my caveat there is, the only thing I'm saying there is that somebody could be using that as a post-COVID recovery tool, but it may be they've always had a poor BOLT score and they didn't realize it.
So take it before you need it.
Yeah, take it before you need it. But that's one way to keep an eye on it. Using something like a pulse oximeter, which, you know, that's a little finger probe we use in hospital to measure your blood oxygen saturation levels. I think a lot of people have these at home now, and you can buy them quite cheaply. Now, I'm very much not suggesting anybody takes their own acute illness management into their own hands, monitoring their own blood oxygen saturation. But using it to optimize performance in the sense of, really, it's no different to everybody having a thermometer at home for 100 years and checking their own children's temperature when they're feverish. It's just checking your blood oxygen saturation. And I'd say at rest, you know, if it's anything less than 96, 97%, that's not normal for an athlete.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about this because I bought one, and I didn't buy it until I started to feel better, ironically, but still sort of, Three weeks post having got ill, my O2 sats are still down at 94%, which really surprises me considering I feel well again. And I tried the, what's it called? Is it the post exercise desaturation test where you just walk up and down the stairs a couple of times?
Yeah.
And I watched my oxygen desaturate in front of my eyes as I sat breathless at the top of the stairs after two climbs up the stairs in my house, thinking, I've done several Ironmans. What's going on? Yeah.
Well, so, that is going to be my next one, Rob, is then wear the pulse oximeter and do exactly what you've done there.
Well, can you explain that to me? What's happening in terms of why is the blood deoxygenating with an up and down the stairs?
Well, you're just seeing an exaggeration in that drop. You know, you're already seeing a lower than optimal level when you were at rest, and then it was exaggerated when you did something. As soon as we do something, we're starting to consume oxygen. You know, that's VO2.
Yeah.
And we're just doing it in a more extreme way as we increase exercise. So you had an increase in oxygen consumption, and that wasn't being balanced by adequate oxygen delivery. Now, why your oxygen delivery isn't good enough, that can have lots of different reasons behind it. And obviously, some of those could still be a knock-on effect and you're still recovering from your COVID. So it could still be some lung inflammation, so you're not getting oxygen as efficiently as before across those different barriers into your arteries. And I'm not saying you've got any of this. If we just talk purely about mechanism.
Yeah, sure.
So in terms of getting oxygen to your cells in the end, we need to be able to breathe the oxygen in the right way. So this is where this nasal breathing, deep breathing, et cetera, comes in, breathing in an efficient manner. So it's in the first instance, getting the breath and oxygen into your lungs. The next bit is the lung function itself. Then it's your, whether there's any issues with those little capillaries and arteries in the cardiovascular system. And then if it's somebody who did unfortunately get some heart muscle inflammation or myocarditis directly from the virus itself, which has given them some cardiomyopathy or some, longer term, or maybe it's just short term at this stage, heart muscle damage, which is affecting how well their heart pumps and pumps the blood around. Because it's the first bit is getting the oxygen into your bloodstream, but the next bit is that blood shifting and pumping around the body and getting to the cells. And then the other component to that is your hemoglobin levels, your blood count. Is that optimal? And on the previous podcast, we've spoken about that when you spoke about oxygen deliverability and we spoke about your B12 levels.
That's right.
So really we're looking at everything that you need in terms of nutrients to optimize your hemoglobin levels and make sure they're optimal. And, that's everything from iron to copper to B12, folate, vitamin B6. And, there's a long list of those. And then COVID itself, through its inflammation, could have reduced the blood count. And that's not COVID specifically. Any chronic disease or any high levels of inflammation will impact our ability to make the red blood cells and the hemoglobin in the short term.
So right, I see.
So it could be any one of those. And then it could be that the mitochondria are not back to working efficiently yet, which is really a lot of what's often happening in chronic fatigue, is that the mitochondria, the energy factories, are working inefficiently or malfunctioned or under stress. So it could be any one or several of those. And some of those you can tease out quite easily by checking the blood count and then looking for the causes and fixing it. Others are just going to require more time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more before we finish about myocarditis, because that's the one in particular that's been worrying me about my athletes. Is a couple of guys who they had COVID 6, 8, 10, 12 months ago in a couple of cases. And then obviously we knew an awful lot less 12 months ago than we do now. They recovered, returned to training. And then 6 months later, one of the guys thought he'd had a heart attack and it was later shown to be myocarditis that had caused this. What's happening in terms of how is the COVID creating this inflammation in the heart?
Well, we think that in some people, the virus is directly infecting the myocytes, the cardiac muscle cells, much like it's infecting the lining of your lungs or the lining of the gut or some nerve cells. So it's a direct viral infection there.
I see.
This isn't new. Athletes have contracted myocarditis over the years from cold viruses to all sorts of viruses and other types of infections. And really where they've got into trouble is when they've trained through an infection. So the old story is if you get a bad cold or you think you got the flu, if you've got a fever or your resting heart rate is raised, or now we can even be more sophisticated and look at change in heart rate variability, you don't train. It's just not worth it.
Yeah.
There is just that significant risk that you push it into myocarditis, or the myocarditis that's there becomes a cardiomyopathy. In other words, it becomes permanent damage to the heart muscle, which you potentially don't regain. And that has happened to plenty of athletes over the years. So it's not a new feature of COVID-19. It's a very well-known, risk of pushing your body when you have an infection.
Mm. Okay.
I think just going back to the sensible thing is, we've already spoken about looking at monitoring your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, maybe look at your pulse oximetry changes, look at, do that Bolt test, and, you know, with the breath hold. There's another similar one you can do, and that's a breath hold walking to exhaustion, where you do that same breathe in and out through your nose and pinch your nose closed and see how many steps you can do before you need to take a breath. And if it's less than 50 steps, that's below optimal. So these are kind of practical assessments. And really, I think around specifically the myocarditis, if you recover, specifically if you've got a persistent curious breath, or clearly if you feel like you've got palpitations or regular heart rate, or you get any chest discomfort, you absolutely definitely shouldn't do starting any training until you've had a thorough cardiac workup in the NHS via GP referral. And, you know, we would in the first instance do a 12-lead ECG. We might do one of our heart muscle enzymes called a troponin level, which can indicate the degree of, you know, heart muscle inflammation. And then if it's indicated, they might then go on to do an exercise ECG and a scan of the heart, an echocardiogram. And these are all completely non-invasive tests. So they can quite thoroughly work up that issue and know whether it is a factor or not.
Great. And I think that's really good to highlight again and sort of to say to people, if they're experiencing any of those symptoms when they return to training, just seeing the GP will get them referred and they can have all those tests done. And essentially, it's not saying anything's wrong. It's getting an MOT for your heart to check that things are right with it. It's a really sensible thing to do, isn't it, at this point?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Then in terms of a return to training protocol, I'm going to talk you through kind of what we've put together from reading the advice that we've seen out there. The first thing we've said is you're taking 2 weeks off training completely. And the 2 weeks starts from the first day that you're completely symptom free. And so we've kind of built in a 2 week buffer into this to say from the first day you feel completely symptom free, you're having two more complete weeks off exercise. The first one doing nothing, the second one where you can return to sort of the activities of daily living, go out for a walk, you know, walk the dog for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. Then we're looking at 2 weeks where we're going to alternate exercise, one day on, one day off, starting with very, very easy, like a 50% of FTP spin on the bike for 15 minutes on day one, have a day off. On day two, they do 30 minutes, have a day off. On day three, they do 45 minutes and so on. We build them up to an hour like that across the next 2 weeks. So essentially, we're saying from the point where they're completely free of symptoms, it's going to be at least 4 weeks before they do anything in a higher heart rate level than heart rate zone one, or, you know, really easy recovery type activity. And from that point on, I've built out another 4 weeks that gradually increases the intensity of exercise they do from, if you like, from zone one through to zone three, or from 50% through to 80% of FTP, but across a 4 week period. So it's going to be the ninth week post-symptoms before anybody returns to what we would class as a normal training plan, if you like, a normal training intensity and duration. One of the pushbacks we've got from athletes on this is it seems like we're being overcautious, and people are saying, really, do I really need to take so long to get back? But the thing that's scaring me is we want to do everything we can to allow people to feel as though they're moving forwards, but not so much that we put them at any danger of developing, you know, myocarditis, any of these other problems we've talked about. Does that sound like a sensible or appropriate approach to this?
Well, I think in the absence of doing additional monitoring like we've just been discussing,
yeah,
I think that's a very safe, practical approach for everybody across the board, and you're certainly going to keep everybody safe. But of course, there is a broad spectrum of severity amongst your athletes. And there will be people who would be perfectly safe increasing exercise more than that, earlier than that, and others that may need to wait much longer than that. So I would say, in the absence of people doing some sensible monitoring of where they're up to, what you've described should be what most people do. of course, if people have had very mild disease, completely asymptomatic, and they monitor heart rate variability, they monitor their resting heart rate, do their BOLT score, look at their dynamic oxygen saturation change, you know, do as many dynamic measures as possible of their return to health. And all of those look really good. They could probably take it a little bit quicker than what you've described.
Yeah.
It's impossible to put exact times on this, and any publication out there has made it up because there's no exact research done upon this. And certainly in terms of the worrying one of myocarditis, we don't know when that risk ends. Most cases of myocarditis really occur when you're exercising during the acute, during an acute infection or acute viral illness. So I don't know at which point post-recovery that remains something that you're going to trigger if you start to exercise.
Yeah.
So difficult. But I think if your resting heart rate is still elevated, your HRV is still low, that's potentially putting you into a risk of that.
Yeah.
Your heart rate is really a direct reflection of your heart. In a sense, it's reflecting lots of other things, but ultimately it could be slightly raised because your heart is inflamed, your heart muscle's still inflamed. There are many, many other reasons, but that could be. So I would take that as a very clear indicator not to stop pushing it. What I would be careful of is having a message of sitting on the couch. Because as I said to you earlier, I would do easy walking throughout and regular movement. And I would set an alarm that every hour when you're doing all your home office working on Zoom and whatever, that you get up and you move for 5 minutes. Because I would have the concern of people having an increased propensity for sticky blood and thicker blood that could continue for a good month, 6 weeks post-COVID. And and the best way to prevent issues with that is staying hydrated and moving.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think that's really worth
immobile.
Yeah. And especially with so many people being stuck at home on Zoom.
So there's a big difference between exercising and keeping moving. Yeah. Sorry, Rob.
No, it's fine. I think we had a bit of internet lag there crossing over, but I was totally agreeing. And I think it goes back to what you said earlier when you were talking about diet, about different people are different and respond to the different foods in a different way. We have to understand, and it's obvious to me now, everyone's going to respond to the virus in a different way and get healthy at a different rate. And I think looking at the resting heart rate and the HRV in conjunction with all of this can really give us a lead for the people who, you know, can return to exercise at a normal rate a little bit faster and vice versa. So yeah, that's been really, really helpful, Anton. Thank you very much.
Just a final one, Rob, I was thinking with that group, is the ad on there about heart rate. I know really heart rate has gone out of vogue with for bike training, and it's all about wattage. But this may be actually a useful time to also include your heart rate monitor when you're on the bike and not just for running. Because I would also use heart rate limits, the so-called MAF training. 180 minus your age is a very rough indicator on the bike training as well. In conjunction with setting your FTP limit of 50, 60% FTP, because there may be, if you're still recovering from COVID, there may be a power heart rate disconnect.
Yes.
And you may see, if you're just looking at wattage, you may be going at 50% FTP, but you're suddenly sitting at a heart rate of 150, where normally pre-COVID, your heart rate at that percentage FTP was only 120.
Yeah.
And that may just be a little warning bell that you're not quite ready and back off.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Monitoring the heart rate through all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe the math idea of 180 minus your age and then subtract 10 if you had COVID and take 10 beats off. And that would put you at that sort of, put that as your upper aerobic threshold limit.
Nice.
For your recovery training. And the other thing I'd say is when you look at increase in heart rate and you look at general stress and load on your system, in general, you seem to recover easier and have less of a metabolic load from even quite heavy strength training. So maybe during that recovery phase, they could include more heavy strength training, squatting and deadlifting and all that kind of functional strength training. I'm not talking high intensity CrossFit where you're going to push your heart rate through the roof with metabolic stuff. I'm talking about low rep, heavy lifts, you know, the 3 to 5 rep range, long rests in between. It doesn't seem to take as much out of your system. And I certainly, there's quite a lot to back this up. And I know from myself that it does less to my heart rate variability than what an hour of intervals does on the bike, doing an hour of heavy lifting with weights. So those are the sorts of things that could maybe be brought in earlier while you're delaying the high intensity interval stuff.
Nice. All right. Well, hey, listen, this has been a fascinating talk. Thank you so much. There's so much to go into and so much detail here. If people want to find out more about you and your functional medicine clinic, where can they go to get, you know, if they decide that they want more personalized advice or consultations with you?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Anytime. The website's a long one. So I think if we have the link in the show notes, and as I said, I'd give you that useful nutrient dense food list for people. But it's the 3 W's dot best you, really trying to become the best you can be, -functionalhealthclinic.co.uk.
Awesome stuff.
What a mouthful.
Well, like I said, I'll make sure I put that link in the show notes and people can click through. And then it's always great to have someone like you who people can go to, who both have this incredibly intensive medical knowledge, but also the understanding of the athlete mind and the athlete brain and the kind of things that we do. And that crossover, I think, is a pretty rare thing to come across. So it's been great having you on and sharing your knowledge. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Rob. And sorry we've overrun to that extent. I hope we haven't bored people to death with a lengthy podcast.
Mate, not at all. I think it'll be a good one for people's long run to dig into and hear all the details. It's been great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
So then, guys, I hope you got a lot from that. That's absolutely tons of information. And I was looking over my notes and I think I made, 5 slides of A4 notes going through that, listening to Anton. So, loads of information for preventing you and your family members from getting the disease, reducing the severity if you have it, and in managing the recovery process. Shout out to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. Remember, you can take that online sweat test to see if you're a particularly heavy or particularly salty sweater. If you are, their electrolytes are, in my opinion, the best on the market. They're available in different strengths to match how you sweat. So if, like me, it turns out you're a very, very salty sweater, you can get their pH 1500 milligram sachets. Absolutely fantastic at replacing those electrolytes that you lose, and that helps you maintain your fluid balance as well. Much, much less incidence of cramps on the turbo for me if I'm using Precision Hydration. Remember, you can get 15% off your first order with the code OXYGENETIC15, and you can book a free hydration call with their experts. There's a link in the show notes to book. There's also a link in the show notes through to Yoga 15. You can get a free 30-day trial of the Yoga 15 program we talked about in the last episode by clicking through from the link in the show notes as well. And if you're interested in talking about triathlon coaching, whether you'd be a good fit for our team, there's also a link in the show notes to book a call with me and have a chat about your triathlon ambitions for this year. Right, everybody. So links in the show notes for all of those sponsors and offers, so you don't have to remember them. And until next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast.